sharp objects restricted beyond this point. Med carts must be locked and keys kept with the duty nurse on call. I knew Zen tried to kill herself, but she's being kept on the psych ward? On the same ward as potentially dangerous patients and people who still pose a risk to themselves or others? I think I've grossly underestimated just how bad Zen's situation is.
The door doesn't just open, Halliday whispers. They have to hit the big green button on the wall by the desk to let you through.
Shh, come on. I recover myself, pressing forward toward the door, knowing how this kind of thing works. The nurse at the psych ward desk is harried, drowning in paperwork, and she's hungry. She won't have had a chance to stop for lunch, which was 5 hours ago now. She's also tired because the department is massively understaffed, and she's doing the job of three people. If we walk right up to her and try to appeal to her humanity, we're going to be met with short shrift. If we waltz right up to the secured access door and punch in the code, a code that could very well be wrong for this part of the building, or might have changed since I was discharged before Christmas, then she isn't going to bat an eyelid. During my time here, I learned fast that if you looked like you were supposed to be somewhere, no one really questioned it. My hand shakes as I punch the 5-digit code Mitch, the nurse who could sing but couldn't dance, gave me when he told me to go and fetch my own damn blanket from the supply counter on the 3rd floor. I'd refused to walk for a long time after I was admitted, and his tough love, coupled with the freezing-ass temperatures in my room at night, were the only things that got me moving.
7-3-8-0-0.
I'm so close to fist pumping in the air when the small green light at the top of the keypad flicks on and a whirring mechanical sounds buzzes out of the lock. That really shouldn't have worked. The hospital's security protocol should be way tighter than this. Access codes should be changed regularly, or at least vary from one section of the building to another. Not complaining, though. Hurrying Halliday through the door, I follow after her, marshaling my expression into a mask of calm. If anyone was really paying attention, they might have asked why two teenage girls wearing cheerleading uniforms were letting themselves into a restricted area. But no one makes a goddamn peep. The psych ward's different to other wards I've been on in the hospital. For starters, there are no bays with curtains around them, drawn closed for privacy. We find ourselves in a long, broad corridor with pale blue walls. Doors line the corridor on either side, with small whiteboards tacked to the walls, detailing patient information and stats, plus any relevant medication information. The bleach smell, overpowering everywhere else, is absent here. The plush, thick cream carpet underfoot makes it feel as though we're walking down the hallway of a 5-star hotel, not the mental health ward of a public hospital. I have to admit, this is way, way nicer than I imagined when I saw where we were heading, I mutter under my breath. God, are they piping in elevator music? Halliday squeaks, almost walking into the back of me in her attempt to stay close.
Dad used to say that elevator music was designed to make people crazy, she says.
I have to agree. The bland, tinkling piano notes are a little too condescending for my liking. I'd probably torch the place and burn it to the ground if I had to listen to this bullshit all day long.
Come on, she's down here, Halliday says, rushing down the hallway.
I thought they wouldn't let you back here.
I was allowed to sit with her for 30 minutes last week. Zen got really agitated when I started talking about school, and they kicked me out. That's when her mom told me not to come back for a while.
We reach the very end of the hall, and Hal stops in front of the last door on the right. Sure enough, Zen's name has been drawn onto the whiteboard beside the door, along with a handful of stars and smiley faces that are probably supposed to make this whole experience somehow seem less terrifying. Self-harm risk, intermittent hysteria, catatonic intervals, cognitive behavioral therapist, Dr. Ramda Patel, on call, 100 milligrams Zoloft every 6 hours, Nembutal as needed, next of kin, Angela McReady, 360-545-1865, mother. They tried to put me on antidepressants after my last encounter with Jake. The first few nights in the hospital, I woke up screaming every few hours, gulping like my airways were being closed off all over again.
and Dr. Killington recommended Zoloft. I'd agreed without really thinking about it, willing to try anything if it meant that Jake's face would be banished from my mind. The meds made me sluggish and foggy, though. They made me sweat like crazy. They also gave me insomnia instead of helping me sleep. I refused to take them after only a few days. They'd made Mom explain to me that the meds needed time to settle in my system and that usually those side effects dissipated as time went on. But I'd stood my ground. Feeling that way, so detached from the world, wouldn't have been worth it, even if the meds had helped me sleep.
"Do you think they locked her in?"
Halliday asks, staring down at the door handle like it's a venomous snake. "Doubt it. This isn't prison." I'm hesitant, though. Maybe they have locked her in. If the doctors consider her a self-harm risk, which she definitely is if she tried to kill herself, then why wouldn't they keep her under lock and key? It'd be bad press for the hospital if she managed to find her way up to the roof and throw herself off it. When I try the handle, however, the door opens easily and swings open. There, on the bed beneath the window, Zen, with her hair cropped unbelievably close to her skull, lies fast asleep under a dusky violet comforter, propped up on thick, fluffy pillows that I know from firsthand experience are not hospital issue. Her mom must have brought stuff from home for her. The posters on the walls, the stylized family photos in the silver frames on the windowsill, the cute stuffed elephants on the nightstand, the stack of books on the desk against the wall, all of these little touches make the room feel less sterile, but also make it seem like Zen might have moved in for the foreseeable future. The television, mounted to the wall, is turned to some soapy teen drama, the volume down low. Halliday stands by Zen's bedside, her eyes roaming up and down her still, almost lifeless figure, and a stab of jealousy knifes through me. Hal never visited me in the hospital. She and Zen were friends, obviously, but they were never as close as she was with me. The look of pure misery on her face now makes me want to scream at her for being absent when I needed her.
"She looks so tired," Halliday whispers. "Maybe we shouldn't wake her."
It's true that the delicate purple shadows beneath Zen's closed eyes make her look exhausted, even in rest. I remember the weeks that followed that night in Mr. Wickham's bathroom. All I did was sleep. I locked myself away in my room as often as I could, refusing to interact with the world. I sank into the oblivion that unconsciousness offered me, and I did everything in my power to stay that way. Sleeping 18 hours a day, checking out of reality, was far easier than facing it. Depression affects people differently, though. Zen might struggle to pass out at all, without the drugs to keep her under. She might be plagued by insomnia.
"We'll sit and wait a minute," I say, moving to stand by the window. I'm on edge. No way I'm going to be able to relax. My own time here aside, I'm dreading the moment when Zen stirs and wakes up. The last time I saw her, she was fighting with Rosa Jimenez, who was sawing hanks of her gorgeous afro off by the handful, settling an account between them that was long overdue. I'd felt sorry for Zen, but I'd also felt vindicated. I'd decided that she deserved the punishment, served up to her in front of the whole school, because of the way she'd treated me at Casey's behest. Her dogged pursuit of Alex had made me despise her even more than I already had, and it had seemed about time for karma to leap up and bite Zen in the ass. I hadn't known then that she'd suffered the same violence at Jake's hands that I had. When I'd found out what he and his asshole buddies had done to her, my initial response to that information still brings me a deep and harrowing shame. For one awful moment again, I'd thought, serves her right. She knew what he'd done to me, and she'd shunned me for it. She'd mocked and harassed me along with the rest of the school and done nothing about the pain they'd inflicted upon me. She'd stood by while Jake and his friends got off scot-free for assaulting me, leaving them free to do it again to someone else. For one awful microsecond, when my anger and my hurt had gotten the better of me, it seemed only fair that they had ended up hurting someone else, and that someone else had been her. The moment had been so fleeting that it barely even registered as a complete thought, but I knew my mind had gone there. The rank taste of such a vile, unkind thought left a sourness in my mouth that's never really disappeared. And standing here in Zen's room this afternoon,
understanding exactly what she went through and how badly it must have scarred her, it feels like she's going to take one look at me and know that I wished this misery upon her in a moment of weakness. No one, not even the lowest, shittiest person in the world, should have to cope with the horrors that haunt her whenever she hears the names Jacob, Killian, Sam. I stare out of the window, watching the dim glow of the sun fade over the forest on the other side of the hospital parking lot, trying to unravel the mess I find myself tangled up in. When did we stop supporting each other? When did it become more important to bow and scrape to the likes of Jake Weaving than to have each other's backs? When did our friendships lose their value so dramatically that we were willing to overlook heinous, brutal crimes simply to maintain our status in the pointless, short-term ecosystem that is high school? Halliday sits on the edge of the chair by the desk, watching me intently. The weight of her gaze on my back burns through the fabric of my cheer uniform. I know she wants to talk to me, but I'm not interested in a catch-up session. Not right now. My mind's racing, too full, too many thoughts chasing around one another in a maddening dervish. It's taking all my strength just to stand quietly at the window without screaming at the top of my lungs. A long time passes. I grow numb as I watch the dusk creep over the horizon. All of a sudden, it's fully dark outside, and there are pinpricks of flickering white light scattered across the clear night sky. "Beautiful, huh?" Halliday murmurs beside me. God knows when she came and stood beside me, but I get the feeling from the way she's dejectedly resting her forehead against the glass that she's been there a while. "Remember when we were little? We used to try and count them all. We thought if we closed one eye and worked our way from left to right, we'd be able to keep track."
"I remember."
The croaky voice on the other side of the room startles both of us. I must have been really zoned out, because Zen is awake and she's sitting up in the bed, hugging her knees to her chest.
"Casey used to laugh at us," she says quietly. "She said we were stupid for even trying, but we never listened. We used to sit outside in our sleeping bags in the middle of winter and stuff our faces with marshmallows."
Four young girls, still children, huddled together for warmth and laughing up at the sky.
Those memories seem so distant now that it comes as a shock to even recall them. We were innocent once. We weren't always this selfish, unkind, lost.
"Othello pooped in your hoodie," I say, smirking a little. Othello, Zen's old family dog, had come with us on a number of trips up to the cabin. He always looked like he was grinning, tongue lolling out of the side of his head. Usually meant he'd shit somewhere he wasn't supposed to. The hoodie shitting incident had been particularly unfortunate because Zen hadn't noticed the present Othello had deposited in her clothes and had put on the hoodie in question. It had taken at least half an hour for the smell to become unbearable, at which point we'd discovered the smeared dog shit caked deep into the back of Zen's tightly curled hair. She huffs sadly, rubbing her hand over the back of her bare skull, her eyes gazing unfocused out of the window.
"Yeah, I guess I don't need to worry about getting shit in my hair anymore, huh? I'm going for a more minimalist look these days."
"I think it looks cool," Halliday offers very seriously, heading over to sit on the edge of Zen's bed. "Edgy, you know? Very Demi Moore in G.I. Jane." Zen hides her face behind her legs, so only her eyes are peeking out over the tops of her knees.
"Come on. We all know it's more of a Britney post-meltdown look."
"No, no way," Hal shakes her head firmly. "Britney was fucking crazy." This elicits a hard, derisory bark of laughter from the bald girl in the bed.
"In case you haven't noticed, I'm being held captive in a hospital psychiatric ward. That's usually where they put the crazy people, Hal."
Halliday groans, shoving at Zen until she grudgingly shifts over in the bed, making room for her. Once she's settled and she's made herself comfortable, her back bolstered up against the pillows, Halliday puts an arm around Zen's shoulder and forces her to snuggle. Zen, always loud, always confident, always brash and larger than life, looks like a broken and frail little girl tucked into Halliday's side.
"There's a difference between crazy and sad,"
You haven't lost your mind, she whispers.
Feels like it.
Zen's eyes close. She folds her arms into her chest, curling up tighter against Halliday. And for the first time, I notice the white dressings wrapped around both of her wrists. I assumed Zen had taken a bunch of pills or something. I imagined herself getting comfortable in bed and relaxing, tossing a bunch of Vicodin down her throat and polishing it all off with a bottle of Malbec. Seemed like a very Zen suicide attempt. Slitting your wrists is another level. From the way her dressings are taped, she cut vertically, not horizontally. She meant business. This wasn't a cry for help. She wanted to purge her blood, like letting it out would release all of her pain and the poison inside of her at the same time. Holy shit. Zen takes a shuddering breath and opens her eyes, slowly turning her head to look at me. The first time she's looked at me without open hatred on her face in nearly a year.
What did she have to say to talk you into this? Or was the chance to say, I told you so, too good to pass up? She asks stiffly.
I have to push around the block in my throat in order to speak. It isn't an easy task.
I only came for the food. Wednesdays are meatloaf night in the cafeteria.
Zen pulls a face, smiling a little, but the wariness in her eyes let me know that my presence here is putting her on edge. I'm right there with her. Suddenly this all seems too much, and I'm too tired and run down by everything to stand up a second longer. I slump down into the chair Halliday was occupying before, sighing heavily.
I'm not here to make you feel bad, Zen. I'm not here to make you feel better either. I'm just here.
That's what I needed, back then, to not be alone. I didn't want the fuss and the blame or the pity and the questions. I just wanted to feel like I wasn't tumbling down into the murky black depths of a bottomless pit all by myself. It would have been comforting to know that I could have reached out at any point and somebody would have taken hold of my hand. There have been many wrongs committed over the past 12 months. Zen's far from free of blame, but it serves no purpose to cling on to that at the moment. If she needs me, then I'll be here for her. Because right here, right now, that's the right thing to do.
At 7, a nurse busts us in Zen's room and shoos us out before evening visitation hours. She could cause a real stink, since we broke into the ward and flaunted a number of the hospital's other rules in the process, but she does the kind thing and advises us not to do it again. Halliday and I hurry away from the psychiatric ward like there's a fire licking at our heels. As we cut through the emergency room to make our way out of the hospital, a familiar face halts me in my tracks. The woman smiles broadly at me, weaving her way across the crowded ER.
Hi, Silver. Great to see you up and on your feet. Tell me you haven't been performing any split lifts, though, she says, eyeing my siren's uniform. 'Cause that would not be smart.
No, Dr. Romero, I'm starting off slow, keeping my feet on the ground until I get the all clear from you guys.
Behind her, a tall guy in a black sweatshirt and black jeans approaches, sliding a cell phone into his back pocket. The very embodiment of intimidation, he looks like he's about to tear one of the waiting room chairs out of the ground and start trashing the place. A deep, unhappy frown marks his brow. I'm about to warn Dr. Romero that a dangerous-looking, inked-up psychopath is about to lynch her, but then the guy slides his arm around her waist. Well, fuck me. How ironic is this? I took one look at Dr. Romero, and I took one look at the guy, and decided there wasn't a realm or plane of reality in which they might possibly be together, which is exactly what other people do when they see me and Alex walking down the street together, holding hands. I look wholesome, the same way Dr. Romero does. Our men both look like they just got spat out of hell because even the halls of the damned couldn't contain them. Beside me, Halliday squeaks nervously, plucking at my sleeve.
I'll meet you by the car. I need to make a phone call.
I hope to God she's not calling 911.
All good?
The huge guy asks, giving Dr. Romero a smile that borders on frightening. The smile the doctor returns to him is far sweeter.
Just saying hello to a previous patient. Silver, this is Zeth. He's my... well, he's mine.
She says, laughing awkwardly. The guy, Zeth, turns his attention to me, nodding just the once, and I almost mimic Halliday and make a run for the door.
"Pleased to meet you,"
he tells me in a deep, rough-edged baritone.
"Likewise."
He brushes a hand possessively over Dr. Romero's hair, smoothing down an errant strand.
"I have something I need to take care of. Be back for you in an hour?"
She nods, and I have to look away from them, embarrassment coursing up and down my spine. The expression on his face is so openly sexual that I nearly burn up from the heat of it. Shit, is this how people feel when they're trapped at close quarters with me and Alex? I seriously hope we're not this fucking obvious. I'm contemplating how best to back away from them without being noticed when I see someone on the other side of the ER that makes my pulse spike through the fucking roof. Narrowing my eyes, I glare at the bastard talking to the nurse at the desk with all the intensity of 1,000 burning suns. Lowell.
"What the fuck did you just say?"
Zeth isn't looking at Dr. Romero anymore. He's looking at me, and I really wish he wasn't. His eyes are sharper than daggers and glint very dangerously indeed.
"Did you just say Lowell?"
Dr. Romero's eyes are on the verge of bugging out of her head. She looks at Zeth, then back at me, tightening her hand around the white lab coat she's holding. I've said something wrong somehow, and I have no idea how to fix it.
"Yeah, a detective with the DEA."
Seth's back straightens.
"Here?"
Nervously, I point over to the detective, unsure if I'm doing the right thing.
"He questioned me about what happened when I was attacked. He implied that I'd made it up or something. I accused him of taking a bribe from the Weaving family, and things got a little ugly."
The rigidity in Zeth's body eases. Even Dr. Romero seems to relax. Seth's dark eyes bore into the detective, though, still just as cutting as they were a moment ago.
"No such thing as a coincidence,"
he growls.
"I'll go talk to him."
"Hey, don't," Dr. Romero pleads. "Go, run your errands. I'll make sure the guy doesn't cause any problems here. It's all good. Seriously. Please."
I wouldn't have thought a freight train could stop this guy once he gets an idea in his head, but that one word from Dr. Romero, "please," has him pumping the brakes hard.
"Fine. Okay. Let me know if you need me."
He nods to me again, giving me an approximation of a smile. Reaching into his pocket, he takes out a wallet and produces a plain card from inside.
"That fucker causes you any more trouble, you call this number."
I take the card from him, noting that there's no name on it, no address, no business information. Just a Seattle number printed on the face of the cardstock in stark, unassuming characters.
Thanks?
I'm worn thin from spending time with Zen, and this weird interaction has officially fried my brain. I need to get the fuck out of here. Bidding the doctor and her whatever he is, goodbye, would be the polite thing to do, but I'm too turned around to come up with the words. I hurry out of the hospital, ignoring the cold wind that slams me right in the face as I step out into the lot, and I don't stop walking until I reach Halliday's car.
"What was that all about?"
Hal asks when I throw myself into the passenger seat.
"I have no idea. I really don't want to know. Come on, let's get out of here. I've had enough of this place to last me a goddamn lifetime."
Halliday turns the key in the car's ignition, bringing the vehicle to life. She puts the car in reverse, only she doesn't execute the maneuver. When I look at her, fat, unhappy tears are streaking down her cheeks.
"Jesus, what is it, Hal?"
She sniffs, aggressively rubbing at her nose with the back of her hand like she's mad at herself.
"I wasn't supposed to say..."
Her voice is thick and clogged up with emotion.
"You know me, though,"
she says, smiling brokenly through her tears.
"I don't hold up well under pressure. Zen, things are far more complicated than they seem. She's fucking pregnant."
My blood runs ice cold in my veins. At the same time, Sam Hawthorne's voice whispers at me from the grave.
"If you wind up pregnant, that'd probably be really bad, don't you think? You'd have to explain that you went whoring around with not one, but three guys."
Detective Lowell suggested I was thinking too logically when I walked in that pharmacy after Leon Wickman's party and downed a morning after pill. Sam planted the seed in my head, though. He'd painted a picture, and I'd wanted to avoid that terrible outcome at all costs.
Doesn't look like he had the same little chat with Zen.
17. Alex. The week passes by and things settle into a weird, off-kilter routine. I pick Silver up in the Camaro, waiting in the driveway for her to come flying out of the house with her guitar case clutched under one arm, her hair flying all over the place in the wind. On the way to Raleigh, I make a point of discussing what's going on inside my head, even though it's dark and fucked up, and I don't want to. I'm no good at talking about my fucking feelings like a little bitch in therapy, but sharing things with Silver is different. She doesn't judge me for whatever I'm thinking. I don't feel any less Alex, the unstoppable, undefeatable rebel of Raleigh High, for revealing the tender, raw parts of myself to her. If anything, I feel like I'm beginning to understand myself better by looking inwards instead of burying everything down and ignoring it the way I normally would. Giacomo maintains his distance. I teeter on the brink of forgetting that he's even here, poisoning the Raleigh air with his toxicity, but I don't quite manage to pull it off. A part of me can sense the fucker lurking in my peripherals, just waiting for another opportunity to swoop in and turn my shit upside down again. I vow to myself that I won't let his presence affect me, though. For the most part, it works. After our pseudo-fight in the gym, Xander gives me a wide berth, though he does jam the odd post-it through the vent of my locker, bearing highly creative, colorfully offensive names that I assume are all aimed at me. Goat Ball Liquor, Gooch Stain, Jizz Monkey. Occasionally, and disturbingly, the name calling is accompanied by a diagram depicting the name in question. At first, I screwed up the post-its and tossed them in the trash, making sure Xander could see me do it. But I gave up halfway through Wednesday and started collecting them instead. The inside of my locker door is covered in pink, orange, and lime green sticky notes with doodles on them that would make a sailor blush. When Friday rolls around, I wait for Silver in the driveway like usual. But when the door swings open, it isn't my girlfriend who comes stomping down the steps. Wearing a thick black puffer jacket over his red and black flannel pajamas, Cameron evidently hasn't spent much time prepping for his day yet. His hair is a fucking nightmare. I cringe as he makes his way around the Camaro, opens up the passenger door, and climbs on in like it's totally fucking normal. He looks out of the windshield, back up toward the house. When he lifts his mug of coffee to his mouth, the steam from the hot liquid inside fogs up his horn-rimmed glasses. "Asshole," he says into the cup. "I'm sorry, did you just call me an asshole?" He nods. "You bet I did." I mull this over. "Well, I'd say you were the asshole. Where's my coffee?" His stupid puffer jacket rustles when he turns his head to look at me. "It's in the pot, in the kitchen, inside the house. You remember how that works, right? You actually get out of your car, you walk up the stairs, you knock on the front door. No, wait, you know what? Fuck it. You don't even need to knock. You already know you don't. We moved past that stage a long fucking time ago, didn't we?" "Are you mad that I haven't come over to say hi, Cameron?" I ask flatly. "It's more of a manners thing," he counters, his voice weirdly trailing up at the end. Blowing into his coffee, he leans forward and turns the radio on, scrolling through the channels until he finds some CCR. "You and I went on a mission to make another man bleed. You'd think that might earn me the odd hello every once in a while." "This is cute. You've missed me. It's my charming, sunny outlook, right?" I slouch down into my seat, breathing down the front of my jacket, trying to spread some warmth into my torso. My nipples are so cold they could cut glass. Cameron scowls, his lip curling disdainfully. Grumbling, he holds out his mug of coffee. I accept it, taking a deep slug. The liquid inside is scalding hot and bitter as hell, and I almost cry from how beautiful it feels, thawing out my insides. When I go to pass the mug back to Cam, I notice the curly black script that wraps around the white ceramic. "You'll always be my daddy," I read out loud. "Silver gave it to me on Father's Day when she was 6. It's my favorite mug. Can I keep it?" "Stop talking, Moretti, before I rip your tongue right out of your head." He saw my "she calls me daddy now" joke coming a mile away. Okay, that might have been a little on the nose. Cam glowers at me out of the corner of his eye. "My fist'll be on your nose if you're not careful." "You trudge out here in the snow and the cold just to call me names and threaten me, old man? You need to get out of the house more often." He takes a sip of coffee and then hands me the mug again. I drink from it and pass it back without comment this time. "I know you don't want to talk about Ben," he says quietly. "At least not with me. I wouldn't want to either. But I have this cool architectural software I wanted to show you. Figured you might be interested in it. It pisses all over CAD. You can build these 3D liquid surfaces that make buildings look fucking crazy." He chuckles, sipping again, and I try not to feel like he's just punched me in the fucking gut. I'm so used to most men being monumental letdowns on the father figure front that I'm always taken aback and surprised by how consistently good Cameron Parisi is at this. Sure, he might not be my father. I don't want him to be. But he makes a pretty fucking epic friend. Before I can change my mind, I lean across the other side of the car and I pull the dumb bastard into a quick, tight, sideways hug. I release him right away, returning to my side of the vehicle, clearing my throat as I grab his mug from him again. It's easier to drain its contents than it is to meet his eye. Cam sits in stunned silence for a second before he says, "All right, well, cool. I guess we won't talk about that either then. Probably for the best. I finished your coffee." Fidgeting in my seat, I lean on the car horn, willing Silver to hurry the fuck up and come outside so that this tragically uncomfortable moment can be over. "I suppose I'll come up and grab my own on Monday, just to be polite." Cameron smiles, his eyes creasing in the corners, but he does a magnificent job of holding in his laughter. Opening up the passenger door again, he gets out of the car.
"Sounds like a plan. See you then."
The door slams with a thunk, dislodging a chunk of snow from the Camaro's roof, which slides down the windshield onto the hood. Silver's dad ambles back up to the house, his mug dangling from his index finger. Just before he disappears back inside, he turns and flips me the bird, grinning from ear to ear. 18. Alex.
"Class, this is Detective Lowell. He'd like to ask a few of you a couple of questions. He's assured me it won't take long."
At the front of the room, Dr. Harrison looked nervous, like he's secretly been cooking his own meth in the science labs, Heisenberg style, and he's afraid that this DEA agent might smell the crime on him. The agent in question, a shortish guy with a wolfish look to him, doesn't look like he works for the Drug Enforcement Agency. From his slicked back hair, black bomber jacket, and his Nike high tops, he looks like he'd fit right in at a men's clothing store, the kind where hipsters pay through the nose for vintage Gucci fanny packs and secondhand Versace jeans. I already fucking hate him. I hate him even more when Silver passes me a slip of paper that reads, "That's the guy who made out I was lying about Jake." My knuckles crack spectacularly when I crush the slip of paper in my fist, eyes narrowed at the greasy punk standing in front of the class. He radiates smugness in a way that makes me want to take the heel of my fucking Stan Smiths to his face.
"Thanks, man," Detective Lowell says. Dr. Harrison recoils, stepping behind his desk, probably unsure how to proceed since no one has ever called him fucking man before. He's just not that type of guy. "Before any of you start freaking out, I want to make it clear that no one here is in trouble, Lowell announces. He twists a gold ring around his pinky finger, his eyes skipping over the faces of the students in the front row. There have been some accusations made against one of your fellow students, and I'm just here to try and get to the bottom of the whole thing. No stress, no drama. This whole thing is going to be dealt with nice and quick. Asshole. It isn't until Silver boots me under the desk that I realize I've hissed the word out loud, and at least three other people have heard me. Still, I stand by my accusation. This piece of shit is trying to make light of what happened to Silver. By the way he's speaking, you'd think he was here to investigate a missing fucking skateboard. I don't care who he is or what government agency he works for. If he causes problems for Silver, or even thinks about pulling some dodgy shit to get the charges against Jacob dropped, then I will end this cunt myself. First up, I'd like to talk to, Killian Dupree. This motherfucker right here. I'm sorry, Detective Lowell, you may have your paperwork mixed up. Killian Dupree isn't in this class anymore. He ended up with a severe case of hypothermia last year, and unfortunately, he's taking a while to recover. Unfortunately? Ha! That fucker got what he deserved. He probably won't be coming back to school for a while yet, Dr. Harrison continues. My colleagues and I are taking his work to him and helping him out at home whenever we can, though. Lowell smirks. His gaze passes over the kid sitting on the other side of Silver, but then he lingers on her, pausing a second too long for comfort. It's as though he's taunting her, teasing her with the name of one of her attackers. If this had happened a month ago, I would have launched myself at this bastard and torn his fucking face off. My temper's cooler now. I know better than to be so reactive when my ass has only just been released from fucking Stafford Creek. This guy will pay, that goes without saying. I'm just going to be a little smarter about it than declaring all-out warfare in front of 30 other witnesses. Nice to know Raleigh's faculty are so accommodating, Lowell says slyly. I heard about Killian's injuries. Such a shame that an athlete in his prime was paralyzed like that. I played high school football. I know how hard it'd be to lose a career under such tragic circumstances. Oh yeah, I can totally see it. This prick on a football team, calling the shots, lording his power over his teammates and terrorizing the other students. I bet this shithead was as bad as weaving. Maybe he didn't try to rape or kill anyone. Maybe he fucking did. Either way, he's the type of guy to bully and manipulate, and that's precisely what he's doing here, in this classroom. This is all a show, supposed to get under Silver's skin. From the way she's nervously tapping the end of her pen against her notebook, I'd say his little performance is working, too. Does the DEA sympathize with rapists now, Detective? I call out. Mr. Moretti, we haven't suspended common decency in class just yet. If you have a question, raise your hand. Dr. Harrison's face is purple. Hilarious that he's taken exception to the fact that I spoke without being given permission first, and not because of what I said. You people know Killian hurts Silver. You all fucking do, I growl. You're all just too chicken shit to hold your hand up and admit you threw your weight behind the wrong fucking team. No one says a word. Members of the chess club and the theater club alike all look down at their hands. Track stars, trendsetters, and teachers' pets. Their heads all hang in shame, looking anywhere and everywhere but at Silver. They know what they did. Every last one of them knows the pain and humiliation they put her through, and not a one of them has the nerve to face her and apologize for it. Motherfuckers. Alex, if you don't curb your language, you're going to find yourself on your way to see Principal Darhauer. Now, Agent Lowell, is there someone else on your list that you'd like to speak to? Agent Lowell's forgotten about Silver. He's turned his gaze onto me, a curious smirk lifting up one side of his mouth. Ah, yeah, Moretti, the trigger-happy kid. I heard they'd let you out. Why would they keep me locked up? I saved someone from being murdered. His smile spreads. We don't know that, though, do we? We can only go off your testimony along with what the girl said. He nods in Silver's direction. You love this kid, sweetheart? You'd lie for him? Say something that wasn't true to get him out of trouble? To my left, Silver looks like she wants to jump out of her chair and carve this guy's face up. My fiery, fierce Argento. Her cheeks burn bright red. I watch the color spread down her neck, feeling my own ire rising. Dr. Harrison, at last, remembers who he is, the adult in charge of this situation, and speaks up.
I don't think this is an appropriate conversation to be had in front of the rest of the class, after all, Agent Lowell. Sorry, but I'm going to have to insist that you talk to any students you wish to question individually. We'll have to call their parents in first as well. I didn't realize what kind of topics you were going to be covering, and without a legal guardian present.
It's okay, Doc, Agent Lowell says, cutting him off. That won't be necessary. I don't think I need to ask those questions after all.
Shh, mi amor. Breathe nice and deep. If you do something stupid, they'll shut you away again. How will you protect her if you're behind bars?
Been a while since I've heard my mother's voice in my head. I heed her, even though it requires monumental effort. My jaw cracks. I've been clenching my teeth so hard that my pulse is strobing in my gums. It'd be so satisfying to lay my fist into that fucker's face. I can already feel it now. The pop of the connection, the blister and sizzle of pain in my knuckles, the rewarding thump of his body hitting the deck. I savor the thought of it, turning it over in my head again and again. I'd sit here for hours, happily caught up in the process of mentally beating the shit out of this guy, but Silver snatches me out of the violent loop. Her hand grasps mine underneath my desk, and the image of Lowell's teeth exploding out of his head blinks out in a flash.
Don't, she pleads under her breath. He's not worth it. They're just clutching at straws. Jake's guilty. The cops know that. There's no way they're gonna let some asshole like Lowell stab holes in their case.
Lowell's still smirking like he knows better. He gives Dr. Harrison an arrogant bow of his head before slipping his hands into the pockets of his jeans and slowly sauntering out of the classroom. Forcing my body into submission, I ease the tension out of my shoulders and sit a little straighter in my chair, shaking free of my anger. Gripping onto it so tightly isn't going to make me feel any better. No, I need to save it for later, for a more opportune moment. Lowell needs to let his guard down at some point. There'll come a time when he gets distracted and he forgets to watch his six, and by then I'll have figured out where he lives. I'll have picked the lock on his front door. I'll be waiting for him in the dark. Smiling, I squeeze Silver's hand, which is still gripping mine tightly under the desk. No worries, Argento. My shit's on lockdown. Nothing to worry about here. For now, at least. The rest of the day, I'm wound so tight, I'm on the verge of snapping. Silver's none the wiser, since I make sure to maintain an ease around her that requires an obscene amount of energy. But on the inside, I seethe away like that storm on the surface of Jupiter that's been raging for hundreds of years. I fidget in my seat in the last class of the day, anxious to get the fuck out of school. Students of Raleigh High, we're pleased to announce that your votes have been counted, and a theme for this year's senior prom has been chosen. Karen, Darhauer's assistant, drones over the PA system. By popular demand, James Bond, Spies and Villains, will be our party motif. Principal Darhauer would like me to mention that all dresses worn by our female student body should be modest, with no slits above the knee, and shoulders should be covered at all times. Karen huffs wearily. It's ludicrous that I should even have to read this part out loud given the year we've already had, but please note, no weapons, real or fake, will be permitted on school property during senior prom. Anyone found in possession of a weapon of any kind, even as part of a costume, will be immediately expelled from this establishment of higher education without discussion. That is all. The bell rings once Karen's done speaking.
My fellow students are all too excited about the prom theme announcement to realize that they're free. I, on the other hand, am already out the fucking door. I drop Silver off to teach her first guitar lesson of the evening, and my blood is still churning with irritation over Lowell. I spend 3 hours on the internet trying to bully my way into the DEA's personal files, but hacking is not my forte, and so I don't get very far. A simple Google search reveals that Agent James Lowell is from Index, an hour east of Seattle. He went to Holcomb High, then on to USC, at which point it becomes difficult to find any information on him at all. The DEA probably don't appreciate their agents splashing their personal lives all over the internet, which explains why he doesn't have a Facebook or an Instagram account. I make myself some food, all the while boiling away, replaying the bastard's targeted words as I down a beer and try to distract myself in front of the television. It's no use, though. I can't soothe the maelstrom of emotions that are tearing around the inside of my head. I need to get into the DEA personal database, and to do that, I need to engage the services of someone far more proficient at hacking than I am. I used to know plenty of people at Bellingham who could breach government-level cybersecurity, but here in Raleigh, my options are pretty thin on the ground. Thin on the ground meaning one person, and that person being Xander fucking Hawkins. No chance I'm asking that douchebag for a favor. I'd rather drive all the way over to Bellingham and drag one of my other contacts out of their beds than owe him shit. I pace the apartment until 9, at which point I realize that I'm gonna go out of my fucking mind unless I do something. So I throw my ass into the Camaro and drive over to Silver's place. I'm a man about it this time. I park in the driveway right behind Cam's van, and I march right up the porch steps. The door's open, just as Cam said it would be, so I let myself in. I haven't even texted Silver to let her know I'm coming over. If I had, she probably would have given her dad a heads up. Halfway through the door to his office, Cameron looks back at me over his shoulder, one eyebrow curved into a question. What the hell are you doing here? His surprise only lasts a second.
Shoes off, he commands. Cleaner's just been. No dirty footprints on the hardwood till Tuesday at the earliest.
When'd you turn into such a mom? I tow off my sneakers, though, kicking them under the mail stand beside Silver's Chucks. Is that grilled cheese I smell?
It's mine. Make your own.
Fair enough.
Harry asked me if you and Silver would play a couple of songs at the diner next week. Don't look at me like that. She told me you could play.
I hit the stairs, flashing Cameron a shit-eating grin over the handrail. I'll think about it.
I'll tell him you're in.
I said I'll think about it. Cam grumbles under his breath as he heads into his office. I resist the temptation to turn around and follow him in there just to torment him some more. He makes it too damn easy, and giving him shit just took my mind off Lowell for a clear 10 seconds. My mood's already improved dramatically because of it. I concocted another plan to relieve my tension on the way over here, though, and I'd much rather follow through on that one. Silver's door is closed when I reach her room. I can hear music playing softly on the other side of it, along with the rhythmic tap, tap, tap of typing on a keyboard. The tapping stops the moment I knock lightly on the wood. Silver stands in the open doorway a second later, drowning in a huge Raleigh High sweater, her hair tied up into a messy knot on the top of her head. Lord have mercy on my soul. The temperature outside's bordering on Arctic, but it's plenty warm in here. Her legs are exposed, the tops of her thighs barely covered by the tiny little gray shorts she's wearing, and my dick stirs treacherously in my pants. I hadn't planned on getting hard until I'd convinced her to take a drive with me, but looks like my cock has other plans. She's so fucking delectable. I want to strip her down, lift her up, pin her to the wall, and drive myself up inside her right here, right now. Alessandro? She tries not to smile.
You expecting someone else?
My voice is a rough growl. My expression, brows drawn together, head lowered, eyes blazing, probably seems a little sinister, but fuck it. I'm feeling a little sinister. I have a number of intentions and none of them are good. I step into Silver, my hands claiming her hips, guiding her back into her room, and her eyes go wide.
Oh, it's like that, is it?
She whispers, lifting her arms to wind them around my neck. I kick the door closed behind me.
You could have messaged. I would have shaved my legs.
She stands up on her tiptoes, trying to plant that delicate pale pink little mouth of hers on mine, searching for a kiss, but I lean back out of reach.
I didn't want you to shave your legs. I didn't want to give you the opportunity to clean yourself. I wanted to taste you just the way you are, Parisi. Your sweat, your pheromones, your cum. I wanted to bury my face between your fucking legs and savor every last bit of you without you smelling like soap. Two tiny little dots of pink blossom like shy flowers high on her cheekbones.
What's wrong with smelling like soap?
She asks in a high-pitched voice. What's wrong with smelling like yourself? I walk her backwards, my fingers digging into her skin through the thin fabric of her skimpy little shorts until the backs of her legs hit the edge of her bed.
I want your sweet, sweet cunt, Dolcezza. If I wanted a mouthful of perfume, I'd have stayed home and rinsed my mouth out with body lotion.
I trail my fingers over the hollow of her neck, my gaze tripping over the red mark that still lingers there from Jacob's noose. The doctors say it'll fade to nothing eventually, that it'll disappear altogether in time, but for now, it's still there, a reminder of the fact that I almost lost her. I pretend like the sight of it doesn't make me angrier than I've ever been in my life. I pretend like I don't see it at all. Silver's oblivious to what I'm thinking, her heart already flying, her pulse visibly jumping in the graceful sweep of her neck.
Jesus, Alex. She whispers.
Get changed, or I'm not going to be welcome in this house, I command.
She feigns ignorance.
What do you mean? What are you talking about?
I'm not letting her pull that shit. You know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm talking about you panting and pleading in my ear. Please, Alex, please. About you screaming my fucking name. About you digging your fingernails into my ass cheeks as I fuck the living shit out of you, and you begging me to go deeper. About my teeth on your collarbone, and my tongue in your mouth, and all of me fucking taking you, and your father trying to knock my fucking teeth out for it. For God's sake, Silver, put some fucking pants on, at least. I'm going out of my mind. She silences me as quickly and effectively as a bullet to the back of the head. Her hand, ah, fuck. She reaches down between our bodies and places her hand right on top of my erection, which is straining against the zipper of my jeans, squeezing fucking hard.
Shh, shh, calm, she murmurs. I'll be a good girl. I'll give you what you need.
Her cheeks are still bright pink, but she seems to have overcome the initial shock of me coming on so strong. Again, she stands on her tiptoes, demanding my mouth. And this time, I give it to her. I'll give her anything she wants if she continues to squeeze and rub my cock the way she's doing right now. I drive my tongue into her mouth, past her soft, pliant lips, kissing her more roughly than I ever have before. And she lets out a low, needy whisper that sets my blood on fire. Quickly, I grab hold of a fistful of her hair, yanking it back so that the sensitive, pale skin of her neck is exposed. I bite down on that delicate skin hard enough to drop blood. Almost.
Alex, fuck!
She tears at my belt, frantically trying to get it open.
Get dressed right fucking now, I snarl.
She looks up at me, eyes the color of a winter stream, sparking with defiance.
Don't tell me what to do.
Before I can say another word, she's unfastened my jeans, pushed them down over my hips, freed my raging hard-on, and she's down on her fucking knees.
No.
I step back, trying to cover myself, forcing myself away from her.
God fucking...
The sight of her like that, on her knees, for me. Shame spills through me, hot, dark, and slick. It's one of my favorite pastimes, imagining fucking her pretty little mouth, driving myself down her throat to the very hilt of my shaft until she's fucking choking on me, unable to breathe around me until I can't take it anymore and I unload in her mouth. I want it. I want it too fucking much. I can't have her take me into her mouth and not be rough with her, though. I'm barely in control of myself as it is. I'll have no hope of reining myself in if she closes her lips around my hard-on, and that makes me feel like a goddamn monster. After the way Weaving, Sam, and Killian treated her, Silver deserves to be treated like a fucking queen. She doesn't need my filthy fantasies sullying her. Trouble is, Silver has a mind of her own, and she doesn't seem like she's going to give up on the idea of blowing me too easily. I must be the only guy in high school to try and stop a girl from shoving his dick in her mouth. Silver shoots a baleful look up at me, grabbing me by the leg of my jeans, which is kind of hilarious.
Why? She demands. I've given you blowjobs before.
It may sound hard to believe, but I'm actually trying to be the good guy here. You don't need to do anything for me. I just want...
Hell no, she scoffs. You don't get to bust in here, turn me on in the space of 5 seconds flat, and then limit what I can and can't do because you think you're somehow doing me a favor. Has it ever occurred to you that the thought of going down on you makes me wet, Alessandro Moretti? That I think about it sometimes, feeling you getting harder and harder in my mouth, shaking because you need to come so bad, and it makes me want to storm into your apartment and demand that you fuck me immediately?
Fuck. She fantasizes about blowing me? I fantasize about eating her pussy so that it doesn't come as such a huge shock. Before Ben died, we were dancing around Silver's desire to test the boundaries of our sex life. She wasn't shy about going after what she wanted then, and now is no different. Hearing her say this out loud is too fucking much, though. I swear to God, if I didn't have her naked really fucking soon, I won't be held accountable for my actions. She's still on her knees, still holding on to my jeans like she's determined to get her way no matter fucking what. A primal desire boils in the pit of my stomach, ordering me to take action. Unlike the anger I've been wrestling to get out from underneath all day, there's no getting out from underneath this, because it is me. I could sooner grow a third arm than overcome this churning need. Stooping down with a deliberate slowness, I take hold of her by the arms, gently but firmly bringing her to her feet. Pants, Parisi. I'm not fucking joking. Don't say another word. I'm fucking begging you. Put on some pants and let's go.
Silver. I assume he's going to drive us back to his place, but Alex burns past the hardware store, gripping the steering wheel, staring intensely out of the windshield, his body locked up and rigid, barely even breathing as he coerces the Camaro through turn after turn into the night. The engine screams as he flattens the gas pedal to the floor, and I sit as still as can be in the passenger seat, trying to process the want that's burning inside me. I've never felt anything like it before. I've needed Alex's touch plenty of times, but this kind of searing heat between us is all new. We haven't had sex since before we found out about Ben. Since then, it's as though there's been an unspoken agreement between us. Alex has needed space to recover from his grief, and I've agreed to give it to him. That space is eating us alive now, though. The air between us is so charged with sexual tension that I'm worried one of us will say something, accidentally touch one another, and the whole damn car will go up in flames. Alex must feel the same way. His eyes remain fixed on the road ahead, the muscles in his arms flexing and unflexing over and over again as he drives. 20 minutes after we leave the Raleigh town limits, I realize where he's taking me. To the place where we first kissed. To the place where we first had sex. My grandfather's cabin. It's perfect.
Friday night, no responsibilities over the weekend, no appointments to attend to. But then, my curiosity forces me to break the silence. What about the store? Don't you have shifts this weekend? He shakes his head stiffly, as if even doing that too enthusiastically might send him hurtling down the face of some great cliff.
Henry doesn't need me, he says through his teeth.
By the time he pulls down the long driveway that leads toward our destination, the pressure between us has built to a fever pitch of insanity. He doesn't even kill the engine when he screeches to a halt in front of the cabin. He kicks open the driver's side door, and then he's charging around the front of the vehicle, briefly illuminated by the twin pillars of white light cast off by the headlights that spear out into the night across Lake Cushman. I fumble to open my door, but Alex is already there. He almost tears the damn thing off its hinges as he wrenches it open. Before I can even take a startled breath, he leans into the car and lifts me out of it, carrying me through the frosty grass that's grown long in front of the cabin. Alex, God, Alex. He sets me down at the top of the porch steps, tearing and ripping at my clothes. He's an animal possessed, and I'm no better. I'm trembling from head to toe as I grab hold of the bottom of his hoodie and pull it up over his head. His t-shirt goes with it, leaving Alex's torso naked in the cold night air. But he doesn't complain. I don't think he even registers the fact. There's enough heat between us, sizzling and crackling like a hungry open flame, that I don't flinch when he rids me of my sweater and the camisole I'm wearing beneath it. 3 feet away, the cabin's front door stands easily within reach, but it might as well be a mile away. We've already waited too long as it is. Another minute to get inside, another second even. It's just not possible. Alex lets out a low, guttural growl as he dips down and grabs my winter boots, tearing them from my feet. He rips my socks off, hurling them away one at a time, leaving me to stand barefoot on the icy wooden deck that wraps around the building. The piercing cold robs me of my breath. Hands working of their own accord, I unfasten the belt at Alex's waist for the second time in the space of an hour, ripping the leather from the loops of his jeans. Alex helps, shoving his pants down, kicking his way out of them. His dark eyes stay fixed on me, never leaving mine for a moment. I strip out of my own sweatpants, the pants he insisted I put on back at the house, and then I step out of my panties, leaving them in a puddle of black lace on the deck by my feet. My bra is the last item of clothing to go. Fully naked and painfully erect, Alex watches me with a dazed adoration on his face as I tease the straps of my bra down over my shoulders, reaching behind my back to unfasten the hook. He sucks in a sharp, agonized breath when I let my underwear fall to the ground and my breasts spring free. We've been frantic for the last 30 seconds, lost to a fierce, carnal insanity, but now we both fall still, looking at each other, eyes roving over hip and shoulder, stomach and thigh. Fog plumes on Alex's breath as he swallows, taking a tentative step toward me. His huge frame towers over me, dwarfing me in a way that makes me feel incredibly small. His dark hair hangs in his face, hiding his eyes. He brushes it out of the way with the sweep of a hand, and the simple gesture makes my heart swell in my chest like never before. I love him so fucking much, every small, beautiful, broken, incredible part of him. And it's all too much. The black ink that creeps up his arms, snaking its way around the collar of his throat in a tangle of rose and thorn, looks like it's shifting in the moonlight that cuts through the clouds overhead, painting his torso silver. It'd be easy to say that he's the most amazing thing I've ever seen and leave it at that. But such a simple description wouldn't do him justice. He isn't just magnificent. He's beyond words, beyond imagination, beyond dreaming. If I live to be 100, I'll never be able to fully explain just how spectacular Alessandro Moretti is naked. He stands tall and proud, unapologetic of the fact that his dick is hard and brushing up against his stomach in a way that draws the eye down.
Argento,
he whispers, sounding almost reproachful. He reaches up and trails his fingers lightly over the side of my face.
I haven't been taking care of you, have I? I've been so wrapped up in all of my own shit, and all that time you've been hungry.
He doesn't pose it as a question. He knows it's true just as well as I do. He can read it on me, the need vibrating off my skin like an electrical charge. On the other side of the lake, a bird calls, its cry cutting the silent night air apart. The sound reminds us both that we're standing outside, naked as the day we were born, in the middle of winter.
"I want you here," Alex rumbles, his voice rough as whiskey and smoke. "I want you under the stars, with the moon on our backs and the cold air in our lungs."
I take him by the hand and lead him back down the porch steps, heading for the jetty that thrusts out onto the lake. Stones and sharp shards of wood bite at the undersides of my feet, but it doesn't take long to cross the clearing. Then the jetty's smooth, frozen planks of wood replace the rough ground, making it much easier to walk. Halfway down the narrow pier, Alex takes hold of me from behind, his hands on my hips, turning me around.
"You're a witch, aren't you? You're gonna steal my soul and leave me to drown, love drunk, in the cold black water."
I close my eyes, smiling. "Huh, so you love me then?" Alex's lips brush lightly against mine, a bristling heat passing between us, despite how gentle he is.
"You know I do," he murmurs against my mouth. "How could I not? You're quicksand. The more I struggle against you, the deeper I sink."
His chest brushes up against my nipples, and a delicious shiver runs through my body. Strange that the ice and the frozen breeze feel like nothing to me, and yet the warmth of Alex's breath skating over my skin has me breaking out in goosebumps. God, I want him so fucking badly. The insides of my thighs are slick, my pussy aching for him to reach between my legs and touch. Finally, I'm done waiting. I've had enough. I can't take it anymore. "I did what you asked, Alex. I got dressed, bolted out of the house without even telling Dad when I was gonna be back. I came all the way out to the cabin with you. It's time I took charge for a while. And you?"
"Me?"
he asks, raising his eyebrows. "You aren't going to say a word. You're going to lie on your back." I reach out for him in a bold move and take hold of him by the dick. "And you're going to stay still. And you're going to let me do whatever the hell I want." Eyes feverishly bright, mouth parted a little from the attention I'm currently showing his cock, as I firmly pump my hand up and down the length of his shaft, he treats me to a scandalous smile. I'm sure I'm the only person in the world who's ever seen him smile properly, like he actually means it.
"And what makes you think I'd sign off on that, Argento?"
"Well," I squeeze him tight, enjoying the way he hisses out a curse word through his teeth. "You just said it yourself. You love me. You'll do anything to make me happy, won't you?" He tips his head back, groaning, and the sound that comes out of him is a mixture of pure ecstasy and pure misery.
"I'm doomed."
"You are. No point in disagreeing with him when he's right." "But so am I. You're my Achilles heel, and I'm your kryptonite. Lucky for us, our weaknesses are also our strengths. Now do it, Moretti. Lie down before I squeeze these." I have him by the balls, literally.
"Whoa now."
He takes hold of me by the wrist, but he doesn't pull my hand away. A playful, crooked smile tugs at his mouth.
"I'll obey you always. I'm yours to command. Better be careful if you ever want kids out of me down the road, though. I think you'll find that part of my anatomy is crucial to the baby-making process."
He's playing around. He nearly keeled over when I told him about Zen's current state. But hearing him talk about kids, our kids, later on, when we're both ready, it makes me dizzy in an intoxicating, very pleasing way. Squeezing slightly harder, pressing the tips of my fingernails into his skin, I arch a cool eyebrow at Alex, giving him an open-mouthed smile. "Down," I order, "before I decide not to fuck you at all." He drops to his knees like he's just been downed by an arrow. He looks up at me, exposing his throat, baring himself to me. The night sky is clear and full of stars. I can see them reflected in his eyes as his gaze meets mine, and the very sight of him takes my breath away. Slowly, he reclines, sinking onto his elbows first before settling onto his back. The muscles in his throat work as he watches me step toward him. Steeling myself, I take a deep breath, refusing to be embarrassed by how completely and utterly naked I am right now. It's tempting to cover myself up and hide from Alex's intense gaze, but that's not how we operate. We've never operated that way. No matter how vulnerable we make each other feel, emotionally or physically, we've never hidden from each other, and it isn't time to start doing so now. Stepping over him, I take a moment to enjoy the sight of him, tattooed and fucking magnificent, laying prone beneath me.
"If you're wondering if it'd be impolite to sit on my face," Alex rumbles, "then the answer's no, it would not. In fact, you'd make me very
Stop talking. The words belong to someone else, someone far braver than me. I don't know what possessed me to make such a forceful command, but Alex immediately obeys, closing his mouth. He breathes out hard down his nose, making his nostrils flare, his hands twitching at his sides. He wants to touch me. The way his fingers keep curling inward makes that perfectly clear. I won't let him yet, though. I want to torture him a little first. I touch my own fingers to my stomach, lightly trailing them over my skin, moving them down, down, down. Alex's eyes widen as he watches me.
"Fuck, dolcezza. Shh."
I try not to gasp when I slide my hand between my legs, parting the folds of my pussy so that he can see all of me. I'm plenty wet and plenty ready. The moment I skate the tip of my middle finger over my clit, a violent shiver slams into me, making my whole body lock up. "Fuck." Alex huffs, but he doesn't say anything. He's learned his lesson. He knows I won't be happy if he speaks again, and so he clenches his jaw tight, staring at the point between my legs where I'm slowly moving my hand, rubbing myself. I feel powerful, looking down at him lying on the frozen boards beneath me. Alex is a fucking hurricane, strong and wild at heart, and somehow he's permitted me to leash him. He could break free of my will at any moment, but he won't. I have hold of him by the soul now, and the knowledge that he trusts me that deeply is a heady, heady thing. A wave of pleasure rockets through me as I slide my finger back, dipping it inside myself, and Alex growls dangerously through his teeth. He moves his hand, not toward his rock-solid cock, but over the edge of the dock. He lets it fall over the side, disturbing the thin sheet of ice that's formed on top of the black water. Wincing against the cold, he keeps his hand there, submerged up to his wrist, his dark eyes burning holes into my naked skin. I catch my bottom lip in between my teeth, wrestling to even out my breath before I speak.
"Take your hand out of the water. You're going to freeze," I pant.
Alex's eyes shine defiantly.
"I need the pain," he grinds out. "I'll come before you even touch me without it."
Another tremor of pleasure chases up my back, this time sheer satisfaction that I've had this kind of effect on him. I let him keep his hand in the water. For now. Slowly, I sink down so that I'm kneeling over him, straddling his hips. With my free hand, I cup my own breast, kneading my flesh, rolling my nipple between my fingers, making myself whimper a little at the brief jolt of pain that relays between my tits, then down to my swollen clit. Alex growls, screwing his eyes shut, angling his head back. This is pure torture for him, and he's enjoying every second of it. His eyes snap open when I lower myself down another few inches, planting myself directly on top of his erection. He lifts his head and shoulders away from the deck, staring down the length of his body, at the point where my pussy is pressing down on his rigid dick. I roll my hips, grinding myself forward against him, now cupping both breasts with both hands, and Alex falls back against the deck again, tensing all over.
"Fuck," he groans breathlessly.
Instead of chastising him, I repeat the motion, rolling my hips back and then forward again, enjoying how easily our bodies slide against each other. The head of his cock rubs hard against my clit, and I let out a hoarse moan of my own. The tendons in Alex's neck and arms stand proud as I rock again and again, brushing both him and me closer to madness. I can already feel it, blurring my senses and robbing me of all thought. My brain is aware of nothing but the sensation of Alex's taut, hot body beneath mine. He's panting just as heavily as me by the time I grab him by the wrist and pull his hand out of the water, placing his palm against my hip.
Pull me down on you, I tell him. Feel how wet I am.
As if the restraints that were holding him down have been broken, Alex snarls, raising his other hand, placing that on my hip too. His fingers gouge into my chilled skin, and he follows my order, pulling me down against him as hard as he can. The pressure and the sensation when he angles his hips up, thrusting his cock forward and up against my pussy, is too much to handle. I cry out, arching my back, finding myself suddenly looking up at the stars, and a bright snap of pain lashes between my nipples. Shit! Alex has risen up, his core supporting his weight, and my left nipple is in his mouth. I see the white flash of his teeth pressing down on the small, tight bud of flesh, and I can tell he's going to bite down again. I'm prepared for it this time. I grind myself forward, winding my fingers into his hair, driving him down onto my breast as electric, delicious, addicting agony zips up and down my body, pooling in the pit of my belly. He isn't supposed to be taking charge yet. I was going to make him wait, but the feel of his erection butting up against my pussy has me weak and boneless, so ready to cave and give myself over to him, and I can't help it.
Do it. Please, Alex. Oh my God, please.
Just like in the hospital when Dr. Romero used that word on her terrifying boyfriend, it has an immediate effect on the man I'm riding now. Alex curses, his hot breath skating over my bare chest, and the next thing I know, I'm on my back. The cold of the icy wood underneath me is shocking for a moment, but then Alex is driving himself up inside me, and suddenly the cold doesn't matter anymore. He fills me to breaking point. He stretches me and he molds me to him, and then he fills me up some more. I claw at his back, clinging onto him like my life depends on it, and the world begins to spin too fast. With every deep, possessive thrust of his cock, Alex squeezes me tighter, on the brink of crushing me. I lean into it, letting myself go. It feels too good to make him stop. For a moment, I exist only on the air that Alex allows to slip into my lungs. Fuck, Silver. Fuck. He sinks himself into me over and over again. I wrap my thighs around his waist, desperately begging for more.
You should have put all of me in the water, Argento, he growls into my ear. No way I can stop this now. Come for me. Come hard so I can feel it.
I don't need to be told. He's grown so hard inside me that it is unavoidable now. I let myself stumble and fall into my orgasm, gulping at the freezing air, unable to even whimper as a wildfire of pleasure rips through my body. Alex leans into me, pressing his forehead against mine, roaring as he climaxes along with me. Despite the bitter cold, the heat between us has doused us both in sweat. We lay panting, blissfully tangled up in each other's limbs for a moment, while we both try to catch our breath.
You're dangerous to my health, Silver Georgina Parisi, Alex whispers against my throat. You're enough to make a man laugh as he gladly dies of pneumonia.
Are you dying? I smile into the lush thickness of his hair.
Any second now, he mumbles.
We better get you inside then. It's him that carries me inside the cabin, though. He's the one who gets a fire going while I shiver in the living room, bundled up in the thickest throw he could find. I call Dad from the cabin's ancient bakelit phone to let him know we're going to be spending the weekend at the cabin. And once we're warm, the frigid chill thawed from our bones, I snuggle into Alex's side, and I give him the news that I've been stewing on ever since this morning when Dad placed my mail in front of me at the breakfast table. Alex? He sounds half drunk and half asleep from the heat. I try not to panic as I rush the words out. I got a final acceptance letter. They've offered me a place at Dartmouth.
19. Alex.
I never dared to have dreams when I lived with Gary. Life hadn't been particularly generous with me and seemed content to continue kicking me in the balls every chance it got. So what was the point in cultivating hopes for the future, a career, a family, a life in which I didn't wake up every day waiting for the next big thing that was going to take my feet out from underneath me? Imagining these things felt like asking for trouble. Trouble already knew where I lived and came knocking on the regular, so why risk inviting it in with things like goals and ambition? The only thing I ever wanted was Ben. Nothing was more important to me than making a home for him, where he walked through the door after being at school all day, and his flesh and blood would be there waiting for him. I wanted to show him how to grow into manhood. I wanted to be a good role model to him. I wanted us to stick together, for him to know that at least I loved him, even if our mother opted out on life and our father opted out on us. I dared to dream that kind of a life. And in a screeching of tires and a crunching of metal, that dream was stolen, snatched away forever. I'd take back all of the shit I gave Jackie if it meant that my brother hadn't died in that stupid fucking people carrier. I'd rescind any claim I had over Ben. Fuck, I'd agree to never even fucking speak to him again if it meant that he was alive and safe and well away from Raleigh. Away from me. Instead, my little brother's lying in a grave, cold and alone, and I keep trying to conjure up a way to fix it, to bring him back from the dead. But all I seem to summon are ghosts. I lost my mother, I lost my brother, and now I know how dangerous it is to dream. Silver wriggles back in her sleep, snuggling into my body, the soft sounds of her slow, even breathing punctuating the deafening